their treaties, conventions, agreements. But what does sustainability mean, and what are the best means and principles to advance sustainable consumption? I'm very pleased to welcome you today to this important discussion, and particularly our distinguished panel. We will start off with a paper by Gerhard Schirhorn, who is professor at the Wuppertal Institute, a renowned institute which has guided discussions about technology, climate change, and sustainable consumption. And he's co-director of a group that specifically looks at future models of sustainable consumption. There's possibly no one who has been as important for such a long time in the world of consumer politics and consumer regulation as Gerhard Schirhorn. And I can report personally that I had a moment where I went through, I'm a historian, where I went through my notes from primary sources, and I suddenly realized this Gerhard Schirhorn is the same Gerhard Schirhorn who chaired an important commission on consumption in the early 70s in West Germany. He's also been involved in the Journal of Consumer Policy, so I'm very much looking forward to his thoughts on sustainability this evening. After the paper, we'll have the benefit of two short comments, one from Jackie Burgess, who is at University College and also involved in Global Action Plan, and secondly by David North, who's Director of Corporate Social Responsibility and Government Affairs at Tesco's. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Gerhard Schirhorn.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very glad to be invited to speak to you on a new view of sustainability that is just emerging. But I have to beg for your indulgence. My English is not at all fluent, so I dare not to speak freely. I shall read out what I have written. And to make things worse, it will be only German English. But I hope it will be understandable at least. The structure of my lecture is as on the display. At the Earth Summit in Rio 1929, the states had agreed, quote, to promote a change towards sustainable patterns of production and consumption, unquote. 10 years later, the UN Commission on Sustainable Development came to the conclusion that since Rio, quote, no major changes have occurred in the unsustainable patterns of consumption and production, which are putting the natural life support system at peril, unquote. As a result, the states agreed at the World Summit at Johannesburg 2002 to, quote, to encourage and promote the development of a 10-year framework of programs in support of regional and national initiative to accelerate the shift towards sustainable consumption and production. That's where we stand. After 12 years, it is indeed time to realize that something is going wrong. Doubtlessly, most people really want the same environment, but there must be some secret influence that leads us to act in the opposite way. The result is called rebound effect. In producing and consuming, we make considerable progress in protecting the environment, but at the same time, both producers and consumers do their bit to increase consumer demand, including the demand for eco-efficient products, to the effect that the demand for goods rebounds. It increases faster than environmental damages per product decrease. The moral of the story seems to be that we should finally stop to override the progress of environmental protection by the growth of demand. But what does that mean? Many people hold that if the consumers would only play their part, we would be well on the way to sustainable development. In the first part of my lecture, I will examine this conclusion and explain why it is wrong. If we stick to it, the only effect will be that after another 12 years, the same UN Commission will once more state that consumption and production patterns have remained unsustainable. In the second part, I will contend that sustainable development can arise from a joint move of production and consumption, but this will surely not occur if both continue to follow the concept of throughput, which has reigned the industrial society and still defends its influence over the ways we think, produce, and consume. Therefore, the crucial question will be what paradigm of sustainability will look like and how to understand it. Now I'm at my first point. First, I want to inquire into the widespread contention that consumers could force producers to provide them with sustainable products if they only would. Since the facts usually are interpreted in the light of this contention, the most frequently drawn conclusion is they will not. And no doubt there are examples that seem to back this conclusion. Consumers sometimes decide against a new product or pattern that would be a progress of sustainability. For instance, German consumers did not buy an economical car by Volkswagen, which was announced to have a fuel consumption of as little as 3 liters. The introduction of the car became a flop. Or American drivers still refuse the idea that gasoline should cost more than they are used to pay, in spite of the fact that they benefit from the lowest gasoline prices in the world and permit themselves the highest fuel consumption. As a consequence, most car producers leave their blueprints in the safe, and with some exceptions, politicians dare not to make laws prescribing that cars should consume less fuel. They even dare not to discuss openly that car drivers pay for less than one half of the costs they are responsible for, and that the other part is externalized, that is, passed on to environment and society. Producers and politicians seem to postpone their possible and necessary contributions to sustainable development, hoping the consumers will finally exercise their authority by decidedly preferring unsustainable products. As consumers do not give the starting signal, producers and politicians do business as usual. To be sure, there are opposite examples as well. Consumers often display that they do care for the environment. So we better ask in what cases they seem to be resistant. Most of these cases are distinguished by what I call adverse competition. I take it as an instance the introduction of a new car with an eco-efficient equipment, which makes the car less polluting and less consuming fossil fuels. This car has to compete with models from other producers that are not as eco-efficient but sold at a lower price or at the same price with better equipment and comfort, or with more horsepower and higher speed. These advantages, however, can be offered because the competing models profit from an externalization of costs, which the eco-efficient car has internalized. So how could one expect that consumers pay a higher price or accept a lower quality for a car that is less damaging to the environment as long as other car owners benefit from polluting and consuming fuel by paying lower prices or enjoying higher qualities? Consumers would accept eco-efficiency even at a higher price, but they would not if they are faced with adverse competition. Producers, on their turn, would introduce eco-efficient innovations, but they cannot if adverse competitors are being rewarded. The conclusion must be that the basis of adverse competition should be eliminated. It seems neither fair nor even reasonable to allow producers to externalize costs and at the same time to urge consumers to choose products that protect the environment. The concept of consumer sovereignty is valid only with respect to reasonable options consumers are presented with. To expect that consumers buy an eco-efficient but expensive product under conditions of adverse competition equals the suggestion that they might pay for doing a good deed while others are rewarded for omitting it. It is not reasonable to extend consumer sovereignty to self-deception. Second point. Now let us look at those cases where consumers practice sustainable lifestyles. An overall finding seems to be that the regard for our natural and social environment is the effect, but not likely the motive of such lifestyles. The concern for natural resources is based less on ecological considerations than on the preference for a simple life, or on the need for a healthy life, or on the insight that less is more. What all these approaches have in common is the idea that a meaningful life does include more than material wealth. In particular, the authentic needs of human people include, first, to have enough time and awareness for their health, their environment, their friends and fellows, their community, and second, to be competent, creative, and self-determined. In other words, what authenticity requires to do justice to oneself and others. An outstanding example is Bilanci di Giustizia, a group of around 500 families all over northern Italy. Their members are guided by the idea of doing justice to the environment, to developing countries, to social initiatives, etc. They judge the success they have by their monthly expenses, which they sum up in monthly balance sheets. That's why they chose the name Bilanci di Giustizia. They want to be fair in their consumption. They try to account to themselves what they did and find out whether they have contributed to really important aims like own production, buying organic food and clothing, preferring products of fair trade, practicing hospitality, giving donations to social, cultural, and religious purposes, investing in ecological firms or movements. They do that in an undogmatic way, cheerfully, flexibly, and convivially. The results are impressive. They spend less money than the average Italian family, for instance, on food, clothing, car, electricity, or chemical cleansing agents. They buy more at the producers in their surroundings, and if possible, they buy jointly. They do more self-production of food and clothing, and they have more time for themselves, their families, and communities. There are a lot of further examples, each of them different to most others and many outstanding. In England, one might think of the Campbell movement. They all show an affinity to the authentic needs of both human people and their natural environment. But no one example is suitable to be generalized. The chance to live according to one's authentic needs is restricted to a minority. I will shortly present three arguments to underpin this statement. The influence of circumstance, the power of socialization, and the seduction of pleasure and comfort. As to the influence of circumstance, let me draw your attention to the book by Jerome Siegel titled Graceful Simplicity, Towards a Philosophy and Politics of Simple Living. The good life, Siegel argues, quote, is a form of simple living. It is found primarily in meaningful activity and the simple pleasures of friends and family. It requires an abundance of time to do things right. Unquote. The questions why people have trouble with simplicity, he questions why people have trouble with simplicity, and he finds that the main reason is the pressure to buy material goods and services. Siegel invested what people have to spend on 7 core economic needs, namely housing, transportation, food, health care, clothing, education, and economic security. He draw the following conclusions. First, private households in the United States spend between 38% and 35% of their income for these 7 needs together. Altogether, people with lower incomes spend 85%, and people with higher incomes 83%, which suggests that there may be no much choice to spend less. Indeed, most of the expenditure is forced by life circumstances. Consider only the absence or weakness of public transport, which makes it necessary to drive a car, or think of the average cost of housing, food, and medical care. Another part of the expenditure is needed as compensation for odious work, time stress, and social isolation. That is why only families in niches succeed to reduce their working time and income and to devote themselves to family, friends, community, and culture. Siegel pleads for a politics of simple living, to grant people the option to organize a somewhat simpler life. He holds that governments should, among others, provide the possibility of choosing part-time work, lower the cost of the core economic needs, and foster the supply of meaningful work. Other authors present a somewhat wider variety of measures in order to secure people's options to choose a simple living. But governments continue to believe that what the country needs is just the opposite, namely full-time work and faster-growing sales, incomes, and tax revenues. Thus, there is hardly a chance for a politics of simple living, or, as Christa Sanne takes it, for the, quote, unmaking of consumer culture, unquote. Consequently, one cannot blame anybody for making buying decisions which contribute to an excess of demand over environmental protection. One must concede that the majority is not likely to autonomously decide for a modern life, for a moderate life. They will not because they cannot. They cannot because circumstances are against it. Not only external circumstances, but as well internal factors. As at best, 1/4 of the people in industrial societies is open for the post-material values of being. The other 3/4 are more or less guided by the values of having that are associated with the industrial culture. By the concept of these core values, to have and to be, Erich Fromm has defined 2 contrasting results of socialization which determine consumer behavior. Edward Deci, Richard Ryan, and colleagues of Rochester have shown how socialization brings about those values and how the resulting attitudes influence behavior. Out of a great many of research, I use 1 study by Kessa and Ryan to illustrate my point. In American surveys, the 2 researchers found the following 6 types of life aspiration. Thank you. The first 3 are extrinsic aspirations, being wealthy, famous, and physically attractive. They are, as DC says, the stuff the American dream is made of. They are called intrinsic because, quote, the desired outcomes are instrumental for still other ends. Money brings power and material possessions. Fame opens doors and may lead to a shower of gifts. A beautiful image provides options for glamorous escorts, marketing opportunities, and unending attention. In contrast, the other 3 aspirations are referred to as intrinsic because they provide their own reward and help to satisfy people's innate needs for competence, autonomy, and relatedness. These three are having satisfied personal relationships, making contributions to the community, and growing as individuals. They are satisfying in their own right. People feel significant personal gratification from the three intrinsic outcomes, whether or not they additionally lead to other ends. Unquote. Of course, both kinds of aspirations belong to human life. The extrinsic ones, which bring attention to what one has, are not less important than the intrinsic aspirations that focus on what one is. But socialization in industrial societies has a stronger impact on aspirations to have, while the values of being are rather neglected. This finding is very solidly underpinned by research, so that I do not go into details. This is last book, Why We Do What We Do, presents a comprehensive overview. The study by Kesser and Ryan focused on the resulting imbalance between the aspirations. It confirmed the assumption that people who place undue weight on extrinsic aspirations have been socialized in a rather controlling or neglecting or overprotecting atmosphere, while people with well-balanced aspirations have grown up in nurturing and autonomy-supportive families. Control, neglection, and overprotection tend to undermine children's feeling of autonomy, since they give them the impression that acting voluntarily and self-determinedly is neither desired nor successful. Unfortunately, all three behaviors are reinforced by industrialist surroundings. Parents live in controlling settings themselves. They cannot afford enough time for the children. Their attention is absorbed by a flood of external stimuli. They are fascinated by material goods. They are used to reward children with goods, etc. Therefore, one must not be surprised that in industrial countries, the majority is socialized to place more weight on wealth and consumption than on relationship, community, and personal growth. Please. Next point. As values and aspirations guide behavior, they also determine to which temptations we give in and which we resist. Sustainability requires that we resist the temptation to produce and consume more goods and services than are adequate, enough, and satisfactory for a modest living. It does not at all mean to do without material goods, but to be content with what is satisfactory. And everybody knows that we have something inward, as the wisdom of the body, that tells us how much is enough. But very often it is overridden by a desire to want more of a good thing that leads people into risks to long-term well-being, as Thomas Prinsen has put it. Why we are inclined to overdo things has been plausibly explained by Tivochitovsky, who derived two insights from the neurophysiological theory of arousal. First, as long as a need is being fulfilled, we experience feelings of pleasure, e.g. we are eating with appetite. Second, when the fulfillment has reached an optimal level of arousal, we have feelings of comfort, e.g. we feel pleasantly sated. Svitovsky explained that the optimal level of arousal will normally only be reached for a short span of time, after that making place for another feeling, for this is the normal procedure with our needs and wants. They arise, they come to the fore, get satisfied, step back, and others come forward. But the desire to want more of a good thing drives us to prolong the feeling of pleasure, so that we, for instance, eat too much. And likewise, we are driven to prolong the feeling of comfort, so that we for instance, eat relatively often and often in order to keep the feeling of being sated all the time. Chytowski called this the seduction of pleasure and the seduction of comfort. The more we are subject to those seductions, the more we neglect the risk to long-term well-being. The risks are that in the end the organism might react with symptoms like dissatisfaction, frustration, nausea, overweight, illness, depression, or aggression. But these reactions appear with delay, which makes it not easy to identify the risks in due time. Since the seductions belong to our everyday life, we need guidance to moderation. This has been known ever since man began to reflect over his well-being. In ancient times, a rule of the practice of moderation was engraved on the Greek temple of Apollo in Delphi. In Latin translation, it read, ne quid nimis, which exactly means not too much of a good thing. Morally, this rule applies to the firm's demand for sales and the consumer's demand for goods as well as to consuming drugs like smoking or drinking. And since it is so reasonable and sane, I wish I could end my lecture by celebrating that venerable rule. But that would sound like preaching freedom to the freedom of the will to prisoners. It would mean to neglect the power of circumstances, to overlook the influence of socialization, and to ignore that both used to direct the seduction of comfort and pleasure to material goods. Being aware of all that, one must admit that expecting moderation of consumers under adverse competition would charge them with a burden they cannot bear. The same holds for producers. They would have to moderate the tendency to colonize everyday action, as Princeton once more says, by introducing ever more commodities, and they too would have to withstand to averse competition, which is quite unreasonable, since it would ruin them. Thus, we have still to look for a passable road to sustainable development. Theodor Adorno coined the sentence, there is no right life in wrong settings, by which he meant that doing the right thing requires that one has a real option to decide to it. The option for sustainable production and consumption is blocked by certain concepts in our minds and by the institutions that operate according to those concepts. One blockade consists of the concept of the market. The market is seen as an arrangement in favor of the suppliers and demanders of a specific good. The role of government and law is restricted to securing the frame for an undisturbed exchange of the good. In other words, markets are conceived in favor of the private interests of their participants. An interference with public interests is supposed to exist only in a small number of cases, such as the access to deadly weapons. In general, it is taken for granted that the consumers know what is good for them and the country, and that the competing producers will provide them with what is needed. This assumption does not hold for adverse competition. I have pointed out that consumers on the whole cannot be expected to autonomously change their behavior towards lifestyles that are in contrast to what is supplied, if the supply is reinforced by attractive prices and qualities that are made possible by externalization. The same goes for producers. They too will only move to sustainable production patterns if these are supported by consistent regulation. And all three, consumers, producers, and regulating agencies, will only give up their present habits of thinking and acting if they get a convincing new paradigm that promises to be superior to the present one. It must be consistent with the fact that sustainable development requires collective actions. Actions where people jointly act in their common interest. An instance is social movements. With respect to markets, it would be actions where producers, consumers, and government make common cause without giving up their roles. The current market concept does not pay attention to this aspect. As the problems change, which society has to face, markets have to evolve in order to meet the new challenges. Now a social evolution needs its agents, or perhaps should I better say its midwives and obstetricians. In the end, it is government that issues the appropriate framing conditions, but in order to find out that new conditions are necessary and what they should be, a societal process develops in which variety and in which various groups participate, bringing in their expertise and at the same time representing the public interest. Let me call these groups cooperative actions. It is not new that such groups participate in staking out the market frame, but in former times they mainly used to consist of industrial associations, trade unions, and other private interest groups, for the private interest, out of the supplier side. Consequently, they contributed to a kind of framing that rather prevented sustainable development, since it allowed the externalization of private costs to environment and society. Externalization, if it is allowed by the rules and enforced by competition, renders the market a collective action against sustainability. And that means that markets in the past have been collective actions against sustainability. Today there is and continually develops a much wider variety of cooperative actions, including consumer initiatives, environmental organizations, human rights groups, and other kinds of non-government organizations. The innovation is that cooperative actions now bring in the views of society. For me, as an economist, it seems a revolution what they are working for, since they overthrow an iron rule of economic thinking. Back to Adam Smith, economists have taken for granted that markets contribute to public welfare if those who supply and those who demand are responsible only for their own profit and are not expected to care for social or cultural affairs. Today we gradually learn that profit making can and should be harmonized with the welfare of nature and society. Consequently, cooperative actions extend their activities to stakeholder discourses with single firms, keeping them to their responsibility for environment and people. And as they do so, cooperative actions operate on both levels, the government level as well as the level of single firms, and this makes market evolving to collective actions which contribute to sustainable development. This is what happens before our eyes, and it may be part of the birth of a paradigm of sustainability. This paradigm will surely include more than a new concept of the market. For if all other things remained equal, cooperative actions could only be expected to stop the rebound by persuading producers and consumers to moderate their supply and demand. Judging from the findings I have presented before, this would be an absolutely hopeless beginning, just like tilting at windmills. What we need, in addition, is a different approach to production. Just imagine what would happen if production were no longer subject to the principle of throughput, but to that of metabolism, so that any waste and any emissions were either avoided or upcycled. Upcycling means recycling that produces materials of at least equal quality. In this case, rebound effects would diminish since the demand for goods would be limited by the quantity of goods that could be produced under the conditions of metabolism. And although that quantity would be limited, as everything, it would be by no means small. We have reason to suppose that production under the concept of metabolism can yield an abundance of those goods we need. Thus, the task of sustainability is not to use less nature, but to use it in a harmless way. Firms and households must not be persuaded to produce and consume less goods, but other goods, that is, goods that are produced in another way and are consequently consumed in another way. Metabolic production would involve consumption in the following ways. First, biodegradable products will be produced and disposed of in biological metabolisms so that the waste can serve as biological nutrients for animals, plants, or microorganisms. Consumers will help to take care that the waste is properly separated and recycled. Second, technical products will be produced and disposed of in technical metabolisms so that the waste can serve as technical nutrients in reproducing the same goods or newly producing other goods. Producers will arrange that the used products are taken back, either by themselves or by other firms. Consumers will have to take care that the waste can be taken back. In many cases, they will just lease products instead of buying them. Third, there will be a strict separation of biological and technical metabolisms in consumption as well as in production. Producers will no longer use composite materials, for instance, in packaging or in the interior of cars. Consumers will employ a variety of containers and services for waste disposal. But on the other hand, all biological products will be biodegradable and will rot if thrown away. Following these principles, sustainable production and consumption in the future may well look as different for contemporary consumers as current consumption would have been looked like from the viewpoint of the 18th century. As to the two metabolisms, the biological one can be either natural or designed by industry, while the technical one is decidedly an industrial metabolism since it does not exist in nature, but it can be designed by using the principle of natural metabolisms. I want to cite in my own words an example given by Braungart and McDonough in their book Cradle to Cradle. Paper could be produced instead of cellulose rather by polymerization of synthetic material. The polymer could be designed to be infinitely recyclable at the same level of quantity. The ink, too, could be completely removed from the polymer and reused at the same quality. The principle of metabolism adds a second item to the paradigm of sustainable development. By subjecting production and consumption as far as possible to the metabolism principle, one would decide for the upcycling way of using nature, and by regarding the market as a particular form of collective action, one would make clear that sustainability is a common task, harmonizing the progress of consumption with that of production. There is still one notion left. I personally believe that the sustainability paradigm will be distinguished by stressing not only the ideas of common action and metabolism, but also by the idea of life quality, or even of cultivating nature and human life. Let me consider once more the example of the polymer paper. Not only that this kind of paper, production does not require felling trees, destroying rainforests, and leaching chlorines into waterways. It moreover brings forth a product of different kind and somewhat higher quality. The printing color will be non-toxic and will not rub off the reader's fingers. The pages are white, smooth, and will not turn yellow. The paper is extremely durable. Quote by the book of Bondard and McDonough, although its next life has already been imagined, a book made of this paper is durable enough to last for many generations. It's even waterproof, so you can read it on the, at the beach, even in the hot tub. Unquote. You would read it, quote, not only for its content, but for its sheer tactile pleasure. It celebrates its materials rather than apologizing for them, unquote. This example may illuminate that the factor four philosophy of Ernst Ulrich von Weizsäcker and Emory Lovins, decreasing the use of nature while increasing private and common welfare, that makes factor four, yields a double benefit. In so far, it succeeds to avoid waste and to reuse materials. It eliminates the reason for rebound effects, and in so far, avoidance and upcycling are bound to natural limits. It makes it easier for people to accept these limits, for the two strategies, avoidance and upcycling, are kind to the environment, that is, they are designed to cultivate nature instead of exploiting and destroying it. They bring about a higher quality of goods, and they have to be introduced by public discourse and must be organized as a cooperation of producers and consumers. For all three reasons, they provide for a better understanding that sustainable development can cultivate nature and life. This finally can make it easier for people to find and stick to their authentic needs, to balance their aspirations of having and being, and even to withstand the seductions of comfort and pleasure. Thank you for listening.